Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
It's a Friday Aloha to May from HBR2. It's The Conversation. Making the right decision in housing redevelopment.
Like water for colorant, archetypes in glass and paper.
Another limited green recovery. A sea turtle study says we're not there yet.
It's not football, it's the real gridiron.
Plus the worldview from Deutsche Welle, a big backyard breeze, and why a lawmaker is bent on original intent in today's reality check. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Residents of a Hololu housing project hope they'll have all the right stuff, including more than just working, plumbing, and safety. The Mayor Wright housing property has been slated for redevelopment. No plans have been finalized yet, and residents say they want to know whether the project is going to be rebuilt or extensively remodeled and have a say in that. And they're getting some help. Faith Action for Community Equity is brokering the deal to include tenant input with the administration's preferences. Drew Astolfi is the director of FACE, and he joins us now. Good to see you again.
Hi, Beth Ann. Thanks for having me.
Well, I mean, this really is a different kind of a project than what we would have seen 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think there's been a real shift in how people look at public housing. And in FACE, even, we can sort of see in ourselves. We worked at KVH up in Kalihi Valley Homes at this point, it's almost 15 years ago. And the redevelopment there just didn't work. I mean, it did well for the buildings that got fixed, but a whole set of them have still not been fixed years later.
But it seems to be that there's a shift in the way we look at the people in public housing, too, and that they are worthy of having a say.
Yeah, absolutely.
In how this is either, you know, rebuilt entirely or extensively remodeled.
I think there's a shift in sort of public policy that looks at resident voices as being more important. And certainly this administration has looked at them as being important. And that's different than I think we had in the past.
Yeah, it's not just something that's being bestowed upon a group of people who are needy and have to have a place to be, but really looking at the fact that you have people who are living there who really know what is going to work or perhaps what's not going to work and have an inside track on how things can be shaped and shifted to make it equitable for all.
I think one of the residents, Malia, there said, you know, everyone's an expert on their own life, and we know better about our units than anyone else could possibly know because we've been living in them for years. And I think so tapping that expertise about how people live there is really important. And I'm really happy that the Housing Authority is looking at that.
Well, Hakim Moen Safi has been taking a different tack with this than perhaps we've seen in past, or it just may be the confluence of many different issues and the right timing for it to happen, too.
Well, I definitely think Abercrombie got the right guy. Hakim started his tenure as Housing Authority Director by living in Mayor Wright's for a couple of months, and I think it gives you a completely different perspective when you've actually been there on the ground. And I think his background, which was in development, gives him a different sort of menu of options than people have had in the past. And I'm excited about that. I think it's, you know, I'm really optimistic about what could happen there.
You also have firsthand experience because that's where your office is.
Yeah, that's right. So FACE's office has been in Mayor Wright since 1997. And I think, you know, for us, we've seen sort of there has been a long, slow decline of the property. The only sort of bright spot in that sort of 15 to 20-year decline was when Abercrombie got the hot water again running, which he did really early in his term. I think even before Hakim came in, they were working on that. And I think the thing is, though, that the buildings are just old. They're 50 years old. And I think when they were built, there was sort of a consensus that we'll take public housing, we'll put a lot of low-income people in the same place with no one else around them. And that just hasn't proven to be the best sort of social outcome.
It sounds like a ghetto.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what was inadvertently sort of people drifted towards that.
Plus, there are some, you know, real issues with where it was built. When they erected those buildings 50 years ago, nobody really understood how shallow that water table really is and what that would mean for, you know, years down the line.
Yeah, I think, and there was not a whole lot of other buildings right around there when they built it. And I think since that's happened, there's been shifting in the land, and you can see it in the buildings. Some of the buildings have sort of minor construction damage, that, you know, because the ground settled. And in one case, there's a lanai that's separated a little bit from from the building itself. Now, it's not unsafe. None of those buildings are unsafe. And the structures probably would last a while longer. And I think there's a real – we have sort of two choices forward in the future. One is to take the existing structures and repair them. And the other is to knock it down and rebuild. And I think if we're thinking about the long-term future, knocking it down and rebuilding is not a bad idea. The reason that FACE got into this to organize the residents is because we're in other places where they've knocked it down, residents have been displaced, moved around, never come back. That's not the intent of these guys at this housing authority, but I think we still want to make sure residents have their handle, on the wheel as this thing moves forward, especially if there's redevelopment, because it's the time that's most critical for residents to have a clear and loud voice.
In this case, though, there are places for residents to go while that redevelopment is happening.
Yeah, one of the things that's kind of good about how about doing it as the housing authority is you have a whole another set of properties that people can be moved to temporarily, and the housing authority also has housing vouchers, which could be given to people to allow them to move around if they had to. And I think in some cases people might be happy to do that. For some people they'd rather just go out on the market, take a voucher, and look for a place to live. Some people, though, are going to want to come back. Mayor Rights is different than some of the public housing in Hawaii because the longevity of residents there is pretty serious. And if you walk around, you'll see gardens outside of people's homes that have been, there for 15 years. They're really lush. They're developed gardens. And, I think more than any place we've organized, people have lived there for, in some cases, since it was built.
Which is why people are so invested in what happens and why they believe their voices need to be heard. And Will, tomorrow at your rally.
Yeah, that's right. So tomorrow, Saturday at 6 p.m., we're doing a sign waving in front of the building. The residents have been working on a tenant needs assessment. They've gone door to door for about a month, interviewing their neighbors, coming up with sort of exactly what's going on in each individual unit, but also talking about sort of the social atmosphere in Mayor Rights and what they'd like to see.
And have them do it themselves is a very different set of circumstances than having somebody else come in and do that needs assessment. We'll be talking to you. Hope all goes well tomorrow.
Thanks for having me.
Drew Astolfi is a faith-based community organizer with Faith Action for Community Equity. His focus continues to be on affordable housing. He organized Kukui Gardens once upon a time, and he's helping to complete the sale of the city-owned buildings. And now he's working with Mayor Wright residents on their preferred plan for the project's redevelopment. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. Coming up, art for Dave's sake, why Colleen hates on Monday, and first, a serendipitous disaster in the backyard.
Ulana, Umau, Ukaholabe, Oahu is no stranger to film crews for movie and television productions. There have been many over the years, most recently Hawaii 5-0 and Lost. Many larger projects, though, use another island as the backdrop for their stories. From Elvis Presley's 1961 classic Blue Hawaii to Pirates of the Caribbean and even James Cameron's Avatar, productions shot on Kauai are snapshots of Garden Isle history. Sometimes film crews have gotten more than they bargained for, weather far from the model of sun, sand, and surf. Even more rarely has a crew been able to take advantage of the wrath of the tropics. But there was one time when the surprising benefit to a production created a gripping scene of disaster. It happened in 1992 when a certain film just happened to be on location on Kauai. For today's Backyard Quiz, can you name the film that actually includes some footage of Hurricane Iniki?
I'm Garrick Paikai, and you're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Artist David Belke has worked in a variety of media over the years. He began in watercolor and still creates most of his work in that medium and in stained glass. But his work is not defined by any single approach. Its variety is such that creating a retrospective of his work poses special challenges. What are the themes that recur? What medium best expresses his vision? He's preparing a new exhibit that looks back over years of work, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
This is an ambitious show in the sense that you're trying to kind of sum up a lot of years of work, aren't you?
Yeah. My work is always filled with color, and I like to think of it as being affirmative for life's experiences.
Well, how does color translate into affirmation of life's experiences? That's a
color so expressive, and I can remember first seeing sitting in the art history room looking at the slides. We always called it art in the dark, and being so drawn to people like Paul Gauguin, and mm-hmm. I know that's a dirty word in some Hawaiian enclaves.
Is it really?
Well, he had a very interesting personal life.
No doubt.
Yeah. So,
who doesn't, right?
Right. So the color is a means of expression that first, when I was first given my first set of Prang watercolors back in about sixth grade, purple was always my favorite color, and I was always disappointed if purple wasn't part of the watercolor tray. And there's always some purple in my work. And I've always been drawn to stained glass, and I'm the kid. I went to parochial Lutheran school, repressed all the way through. But I'd sit in the pew in church on Sunday and count the pieces of glass in the windows. I always ran out of room at about 320.
So, well, like all artists, you found a way to put daydreaming to an effective use, right?
That's a very poetic way to say it, Chris. Thank you.
Feel free to use that. But, you know, when I first saw that you started in watercolor, and I had seen your work before, and knowing that you started in watercolor and moved to stained glass, and I remarked when I saw you this morning that I thought that the watercolor kind of morphed into the stained glass work.
I think that's exactly right. And in graduate school in Ohio, I approached several professors and said, I really want to learn stained glass, and they just sort of looked at me and shook their head. And
really? Why?
Well, it was considered a craft, and to elevate it to fine art, that's the touch, right? And
love when academics define these things?
Oh, man. But in a roundabout way, when I was deep in the wintry climes of North Dakota teaching at a state college there, an offer passed in front of my desk, and it was to learn stained glass, and my choice was Pilchuck, which was, of course, Dale Chihuly. And there was something called the Stained Glass School of America out in North Adams, Massachusetts, which was basically a mill town that they were renovating through fine art. Mm-hmm. And I went out and I studied that, and then everything just started to morph. And the retrospective shows about five different styles that I've done over the past 30 years. And it's all based on a personal experience, but I try to be affirmative. Some of these things represent eight-pointed stars that I call meditation medallions. There's a new series of pen and ink crosshatch on top of invented scenes that the core seed is Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey, and it's my personal journey in metaphor. But there's several Hawaiian scenes and looking back in through my imagination into time when the Native Hawaiian people were an effective self-sustaining society.
Pre-contact.
Yeah.
Well, you were telling me that you had met Robert Bly and Joseph Campbell, and that it's clear that your work is informed by that whole, archetypal myths, getting to the myths that all cultures share.
Mm-hmm.
One of the fascinating things about Campbell is finding the common links among cultures that could have had no contact with one another.
Just fantastic. I met both these gentlemen at a educational retreat in the Midwest, and they actually gave me an academic vocabulary for the first time about all these intuitive things that I've been thinking about and feeling. And all of a sudden, I had vocabulary, and I had other books to read, and I had other images to look at. And then, of course, Bill Moyers made Campbell famous with that six-part series on PBS. Mm-hmm. And then I started to read, you know, in that vein. Prior to that, I'd been reading books about a subconscious reality. You know, I was the guy in the 70s who read Carlos Castaneda and the Jane Roberts books and Seth Speaks and all of that kind of thing, just trying to figure out the sublink of consciousness and how we are all related and we are all one. And that's one of my core beliefs. You know, and one of my early series here, I'm not even representing in this upcoming show at GOHA.
Gallery of Hawaii Artists.
Yeah, and I did a series of turtles because at that time I had just moved here over 20 years ago. And the issue was these turtles in Kaneohe Bay that were getting these goiters and cancerous things on their soft tissue.
Yeah.
And my theory was that, you know, what happens to the turtles happens to us. That's how closely things are linked.
Well, there's a little doubt about that, yeah. You know.
So someone said to me, I have a couple people who actually follow me pretty close, and she's a doctor, and she said, I like your art, David, because it's affirming towards life. It's positive.
You can see that in the color palette, and it's not wildly hot color, but you like colors, and this is the stained glass influence. Yeah. You like colors that glow.
Absolutely.
You like iridescence.
I like light. So,
yeah,
so we had that conversation in December about light, and you asked me what was with stained glass, and I said, look, it's all about transcendence. Remember
yeah.
that?
Yeah, sure.
And I was surprised that I had said that, but it's true. You know, there are powers greater than we are collectively.
Mm-hmm.
And as artists, and I know quite a few artists that have this feeling, and it's just up to them to bring the imagery to the canvas or to the paper or to the video or whatever they're working on.
But, you know, the stained glass influence that I see in your work, David, is also that you're not just creating colors and shapes. You're creating colors and shapes with designed to have light shine through them. That's
mm-hmm.
a big difference.
That's it, yeah.
Than something opaque.
Light is the metaphor.
Yeah.
And it's the affirmation, because where would we be without sunlight? Where would we be without moonlight? I walk a dog late at night. I'm always checking the phases of the moon. And
well, the sun rose this morning. That's as much as I know. David, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Good
I appreciate
to have
it.
You. David Belke is an artist whose exhibit, Living Archetypes, opens next Friday at the Gallery of Hawaii Artists, and details are on our HPR2 website.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Travasa Hana, an experiential resort with daily flights to Hana on Mokulele Airlines, celebrating Hawaii through adventure, culinary, culture, fitness, and spa programs. Travasa.com/Hana.
Mango Season's debut in HPR's Atherton at 7:30 on Saturday, June 1st, will feature the release of the group's first CD, Flying Home. The Kickstarter-funded album is a sampling of the sun-kissed island soul jazz born of their travels and stories. The evening celebrates Flying Home with 9 original new works and 5 cover songs sung in 5 different languages. For reservations, call 955-8821 during business hours.
You send me a letter, fill it with moments of home.
Support for The Conversation comes from the First Unitarian Church of Honolulu, located at 2500 Pali Highway. UnitariansofHI.org.
HPR listeners who are also members recognize the vital connection between their support and the station's health. Mahalo to Ilarka Ewan of Kapolei, Richard Cunningham of Hilo, and Malia and Dolan Eversole of Honolulu for their membership gifts. Many members prefer the convenience of giving monthly through the station's lifetime membership program. You can choose the amount you want to give, adjust it at any time in the future, and you'll be secure in knowing you've done your part. Information and a downloadable gift form are at hpr2.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:26. You're listening to The Conversation on Statewide, member-supported HPR2. This week, Colleen Hanabusa introduced legislation to change the Memorial Day holiday back to May 30th. But will Hawaii residents go along with giving up their three-day weekend? CivilBeat.com reporter Chad Blair joins us for today's reality check. Hi, Chad.
Happy Friday. It's not a three-day weekend, though.
It's not a three-day weekend, and if Colleen Hanabusa has her way, maybe it won't be. But, you know, May 30th was the traditional day that we remembered those who gave their lives for our country until 1968, when we thought this whole idea of having three-day weekends was a much better way to go. Why do you think that this moved back to possibly saying, now, to heck with the three-day weekend, we should celebrate it on the day that we've always traditionally celebrated up until that time anyway?
Yeah, I think the Congresswoman does have a good point. I mean, how many people know that Memorial Day came after the Civil War? Who would have remembered that, because we're so obsessed with the three-day weekend? Summer is starting, fire up the barbecue and whatnot. And remember also, this is something I had forgotten, it used to be called Decoration Day, and I think that has to do greatly with the commemoration of our war dead. The other thing that I think Hanabusa was more subtly trying to put across, and this is a little more troubling, is it was actually Dan Inouye's idea to change Memorial Day back to May 30th. He pushed for it for a very long time, of course, a great decorated veteran of World War II. In this manner, Colleen Hanabusa is once again reminding everybody, by the way, Dan Inouye chose me for the job of senator, not Brian Schatz. Hint, hint, I'm the one to go for next year when you vote for the Senate.
I mean, all these subtle hearkenings back to what Senator Inouye supposedly said he wanted to have happen, those reminders are going to keep coming. This one may have some legs to it, may not have some legs to it, but the point of losing a three-day weekend for a lot of people is not necessarily going to be terribly palatable.
The reaction's been mixed. If you go on Facebook and check some of the other social media, some people like the idea, some do not. It is interesting. I think about this. On Monday, last Monday, Memorial Day, on the 27th of this year, many people on Oahu celebrated the day by floating those lanterns out of Ala Moana Beach Park. Interestingly enough, that's a Buddhist tradition that started about 15 years ago to honor not just the war dead, but all dead, and to foster harmony and understanding. Another meaning to Memorial Day.
And that would be really difficult for them to have to move that one.
Yes, I think so too. Well, we could talk about this for days.
Well, I mean, some of this may just have some really practical ramifications that may mean it can or won't happen. We'll talk about it more if it does. Thanks, Chad. Have a good weekend.
Good. I'll see you on Monday.
You bet. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
This is The Conversation on Statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandercook.
A Friday morning always brings a preview of the coming week, at least as far as our news department is concerned. News director Bill Dorman joins us. I'm glad you made it home.
Yes, indeed.
You were late last night on a plane.
And Chris as well, back from Kona. Thanks. We had the privilege of meeting a number of our listeners at an event in Kona yesterday afternoon. Some of the folks who helped us get KHPH on the air, covering the west side of the Big Island. A real reminder of the generosity of spirit that is here in Hawaii across the state. And that actually ties into some of our coverage next week, because we have another story about generosity of spirit, and this one also happens to come from Hawaii Island. There's a program there called the Dorrance Scholarships. Now, this is a full ride for students at UH Hilo who are from Hawaii Island and who are the first in their family to go to college. It's a great program. It's fairly early on in its existence. So Sherry Bracken's going to be checking in with the first class of these students, actually, just wrapped up their first year at UH Hilo. And they have a little twist coming over the summer. I won't do the spoiler. We'll leave that to Sherry to pick up the rest of the story. But really, that idea of, again, I keep coming back to the theme of generosity of spirit. You see it so often in so many different directions, and it's nice when you see it in news stories as well. So it's, and when it's generosity of spirit that involves money, that's a bit unusual as well.
Well, when you're talking about someone's future and the ability to have a very different future because of someone else's vision, and in many cases where they won't have any benefit from it. I mean, the person who is giving it, in the case of the people who have made KHPH possible, that's a different story. But in the story that you're talking about with the scholarships, to be able to see that that's an important thing to do, glad to know that that's not being lost.
Yeah, it's true. You know, and when it comes to money matters, of course, there are always things to talk about. Next week being no exception on the broader sense in terms of government for all the islands. We're sort of in this season of budget season and of mayors and city councils sort of going back and forth,
jockeying over dollars.
Yeah, exactly, and a bit of a financial tussle, and particularly on Oahu, that is coming to a bit of a if not a climax, a bit of new developments next week. Certainly, City Council has its third reading, third public hearing on the budget. So, on a couple of levels, if you're a resident and you have time, you can watch the City Council in action this coming Wednesday. If not, no worries. Wayne Yoshioka is going to be there
he'll
and
be
cover
there for
it,
you.
And he'll let you know how things go. So that's some of it. Yeah.
Well, good. Well, thanks for the preview for next week. Have a good weekend.
You bet. You too.
And we'll talk to you soon. Bill Dorman is the news director for Hawaii Public Radio. Are we there yet? Kids usually ask that on trips, but now researchers are wondering if it's time to delist the green sea turtle. At least some researchers are wondering of that. And one of those would not be Jack Kittinger. His recently released study says even after all the time that the green sea turtle has been on the endangered species list, and it's been there since 1978, the population's recovery just isn't there yet. Stanford Center for Ocean Solutions researcher Jack Kittinger is the co-author of the study, and he joins us by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. Good to talk to you. You know, for the last year or so, we've heard these calls to delist the green sea turtle coming out of ostensibly the Association of Hawaiian Civic Clubs and Westpac that picked up on it a little bit, but for a lot of researchers, they're scratching their heads. And are you one of those?
Well, the news of green sea turtles in Hawaii overall is positive. The populations have increased, and we know this because we monitor nesting at French frigate shoals in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And there's very little disagreement about the overall trend in the population, which is positive. But the question that we asked in this study is whether or not that trend is historically relevant. So 9 out of 10 turtles that you see in coastal waters in Hawaii are from nests that are in that area in French frigate shoals in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And so we wanted to see if that was the pattern historically. And what we found in the historical record was that turtles used to nest all over the archipelago. So while the overall trend is positive currently, our main concerns with this is that if you only have a single site that's attributed to most of the turtle recovery, that inherently means the species is somewhat vulnerable because it's a single site where most of that nesting occurs.
And that the idea of delisting it now would be premature and even dangerous.
Well, there's other threats to the turtle population other than
Sea level rise and things like that might happen, especially if they're only in one area and that area is particularly vulnerable. But when you talk about looking at the comparison of more current years to history, you took a lot of history into account. We're talking when a 700-year period of history, and then the period from 1973 through last year.
That's right. Most of our records come from the 19th century and the early 20th century. And what we see is that turtle nesting was far more spatially distributed around the other islands and in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And so that tells us that while the overall abundance increase is positive, we just don't have recovery of nesting sites. And that's something that you really want for a species such as the green sea turtle, because it takes a long time to get to maturity. They don't reproduce until they're about 3 decades old or so. So it takes a long time for, you know, a young turtle to get to the reproductive age, and that inherently makes it vulnerable as well. So we just see some spatial restriction in the overall recovery, and that really bears on this delisting process, along with a host of other things such as sea level rise, the tumor-forming disease that impacts the population, and other things.
And looking at, though, the practices of the host culture here and some of the issues that they've been raising, when does it get to be enough? Does it have to be back at 100% and not 80%?
Well, that's an interesting thing about the study. Looking back at the record, it's clear that Native Hawaiian societies coexisted with nesting sites in the main Hawaiian Islands, and that's clear from the historical record. And that's evidence that the traditional management system for reef fisheries and for species such as the turtle worked. And so the question now becomes, if we do delist the turtle, and that may be the case, that's, again, subject to this lengthy status review process that a bunch of scientists are involved in, not including myself, but scientists that are convened by the management agencies. What they have to consider is that, if they are to delist it, is also a management plan for the species. And the biggest issue here is, how would you manage a sustainable harvest for a long-lived, vulnerable species of that nature? Obviously, harvesting turtles is a cultural practice in Hawaii. It's been something that was practiced for many centuries prior to the species being listed. And so that becomes a central, I guess, challenge of the managers to grapple with should the turtle population be delisted in the archipelago.
But, Jack, we're in the year 2013, and life looks a lot different now than it did when Native Hawaiians were managing so successfully turtle populations and being able to fish and use the population for a specific purpose. How do we reconcile where we are now with the fact that we're not necessarily going to go back and be solely in that mode?
That's a great question. What we look at, when we look at kind of adaptation now of traditional practices, we really have to think about it in terms of the modern context. What aspects of that traditional practice can we integrate into the modern practice now? And that has to do with the policy context, as well as, what's the appropriate way to take that traditional practice and adapt it to today's conditions. So I'm not sure I have an answer for that, but certainly things were different, back in the day when turtles were only harvested, for example, by Native Hawaiian men of high-ranking status. So things are different back then, but there's still some lessons. Even though society was different and turtle populations and ecosystems were different, there's still a lot of lessons to be gained from that traditional management system, and that's also been a focus for a lot of my research.
But don't we really have to have some of those answers before we decide that it's okay to delist the green sea turtle now?
Absolutely. I think that's a requirement of the delisting process for any species, not just the turtle, is to have a management plan in place. So that's something that the managers, I'm sure it's at the forefront of their thinking. But I think the first part of this is the kind of delisting process that goes on has to, all those things have to be considered in the status review. So that's the first step of this. The second step would be, revising the existing management plan, whether it's delisted or not, based on that status review and what comes out of that. And we think this research is going to be an important part of that. But again, it's just one part of the overall story when it comes to turtle populations in our islands.
But you're making the point that there's still quite a bit of time that has to elapse because there are certain steps that have to be gone through, and the plan has to be appropriate given to where we are now with modern harvesting. What would you say would be a time horizon where a decision would be made on this?
For the status review?
For the status review, and then what happens afterward?
Yeah, I know that the status review, it's ongoing. It's they have a status team that's reviewing all the information, and I think they started meeting late last year, and they're going to go through several more months, as I understand it. That's really a question for the managers. As that timeline shifts a little bit, I'm not sure how the sequester and some of the budgeting issues impact that overall process, but it should be wrapped up, you know, sooner rather than later. I don't think it's going to stretch on through the end of the year. I could be wrong about that. So the decision, you know, it's not imminent, but it's also not too far down the road.
Well, we're going to be watching, and so will you. Thanks so much for joining us again this morning.
Well, thank you, Beth Ann.
Jack Kittinger is an early career fellow at Stanford Center for Ocean Studies and a co-author of the Green Sea Turtle Study. His research explores the social, economic, and cultural factors influencing how people use and perceive and govern natural resources. The study was published in the journal Ecography and is a collaboration of Stanford's Center for Ocean Solutions, NOAA, and the NOAA Pacific Sea Turtle Historical Ecology Working Group. That's a mouthful. You can see it all on HPR2.org.
Hi, good morning. I'm John Black from Kapolei. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
So did you figure out the answer to the quiz yet? Well, let's get back to our story. Hawaii, as you know, is frequently selected by location scouts for big and small screen productions. Often, though, it's Kauai, chosen specifically for its tropical setting and vast expanses of land. It's the backdrop for numerous film productions, including The Descendants, Avatar, and Tropic Thunder. And this morning we asked you which film was shot during and even includes some actual footage of Hurricane Iniki. At its peak on September 11, 1992, Iniki's winds blew with a force of 222 miles per hour. That was more than enough to keep cast and crew ensconced in their hotel, riding out the storm, and not wrapping up the final day of shooting Jurassic Park. That's the quiz from the backyard today. You can send us yours to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you've ever doubted that Hawaii offered a rich vein of material for satire, your doubts will be erased at the Society of Professional Journalists' annual Gridiron Show, when the stories reporters have covered in the past year are explored for their comic potential. The show never disappoints, reminding us that the dividing line between reality and the absurd is a fine one indeed. Bill Sage, writer for The Gridiron Show and man of many voices, spends a good deal of his time straddling that dividing line, and he's with us this morning. And, Bill, I'm trusting you to know the difference between reality and the absurd, but does that difference blur after a while when you're working on this show?
Well, Chris, after about 20 years of writing satire, we're sort of equal opportunity character assassins. The credo of The Gridiron Show has always been all politics is local. And from the first time I was on there, 1992, where I just asked to perform, somebody asked me if I could do Ross Perot's voice. I came on right after Bill Quinn, which was kind of fun.
Uh-huh.
It was a number based on
former governor.
If I only had a brain, and it was something. It was written by Jim Doney, who was another great satirist. But they asked me if I could write, and after that, The Gridiron Show went on pretty much. Well, actually, it started. It had gone moribund for a while. It started out as the Gridiron Show back in the 40s and 50s, then it went moribund and came back in the 60s, then it was just gone for about 20 years. When Mothers Against Drunk Driving started their campaign First Night Alcohol Free, we did it as a fundraiser for them, but we did it in the summer and called it Summer Follies Up and Dumbing It. And at that point, they said, can you write? And I said, yeah. So I've been doing that. So I started just doing satire, and pretty soon it was me and Ben Gutierrez essentially writing every show for the next decade, the two of us, and then Kyoki Kerr and some guys took over, and we threw it open to votes for the people in the cast. So now we have a bigger pool of contributors. But
well, Bill, just to give it some context, what you're doing is you're looking at the news stories of the past year, and you're sort of picking which one can we get a bit out of.
For example,
a skit, a routine, a song.
When you have the Stevie Wonder blunder, as we're calling it, that screams.
Well, you know, and that's what I was thinking when I was thinking about this show, was that you could take some of the news stories of the past year without changing anything, and they would read as satire.
Except you try to make them rhyme and go to a song that people recognize.
The one, if news has a flaw, it's that it doesn't rhyme, but but there's no lack of absurdity, right? I mean,
well, let's put it this way. For example, the millennium, it was an election year, 2000, and I've sort of ended up by default writing the opening number where they try to put a blend of everything in the show, sort of like the overture to a Mozart's.
You're talking about the whole Y2K kerfuffle? Is the world going to end?
That was the 1999 show. By 2000, we knew we were here, but it was election year. So they said, if you ever use John Philip Sousa, a march by Sousa, as an opening number again, we will string you up. But they did not like, oh, wonderful news, it's open season, political targets, watch your butts tonight, we'll drive you bastards nuts. So it was fast and jerky, and the choreographer hated me, so I stayed away from that since then.
Well, you have, for example, just to pick a musical example out of the blue, you could almost do something with Aerosmith music and tie it into a certain piece of legislation.
Mm-hmm. It had its moments, and of course, I don't know if it's in the show or not, but I did write a piece based on Walk This Way.
So-called Steven Tyler bill, the Protect the Celebrities venture.
It rhymed, and perhaps it's a little too coarse for the refined airs of public radio, but old blank rocker thought his fame was a shocker when he da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So we're sort of asked by the director. Robbie Dingman and Kyoki Kerr have been doing yeoman duty for most part of a decade, producing and directing. But we don't like to give too much away because the idea, well, if you've heard it, you don't want to go and see it. But let's just say that we have a team who have black belts in Poison Pen.
Well, you can sort of play this mind game as you look back over the last year. What stories would I satirize? The Wonder Blunder is a no-brainer, the Steven Tyler bill.
Marcy Greenwood was a wonderful story. Of course, Larry Ellis buying Lanai. That's when a billionaire likes toys.
You see, the stories just keep on coming.
And there is one guy. It was just sometimes we find absurd stories like the guy, four men were beaten by a cow femur in Kona. And all of a sudden, everybody's saying, I'm being beaten by a cow. Whether or not this, who knows? So we take the absurd, we try to do sketches.
You do that to the tune of Moon Shadow.
Scotty Khan dissing Hawaii for 5-0. We love.
See, some of these I hadn't even remembered. That's the beauty part.
If you have arrogant actors, especially ones like when they had the.
As opposed to the other kind?
No, well, especially arrogant actors who get DUI'd and lost. Oh, we had lots of material, that sort of stuff. Anytime anybody in position of power is acting a fool, who is John Wyatt? He was the guy on the Bishop Estate who was in the lavatory doing strange.
As I say, reality and satire.
We're getting cut marks from Beth. So but yes, we have a lot of.
Well, but you know, Bill, news people. I mean, that's one of the ways we blow off steam covering the news is, exploring that dividing line.
Let's just say, if you Google Gridiron Honolulu.com, you're going to find some good stuff. It's coming up at the end of July, first week of August, and it'll just sharpen your pens. We'll be there.
Well, Bill, I don't need to tell you to sharpen your wit because it's pretty it's pretty razor sharp right now, but thanks very much for coming on the show and helping us out this morning.
A lot of fun and an honor. Thank you, Chris.
Bill Sage is one of the principal writers for the Society of Professional Journalists Gridiron Show, which will be at Diamond Head Theater August 23rd and 24th. We'll keep you posted as the day draws closer through our HPR2 website.
There's a little voyage we're planning on a brand new white starship. We've got steamer trunks and servants for the cruise. The Atlantic will be spanning on this lovely pleasure trip. Think of all the working people we will use. Rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. What a lovely thing for the servants to do.
If you see a hurricane coming, it might mean higher orange juice prices, but just like predicting the weather, that forecast is not always a sure thing.
You know, we've learned a few painful lessons over the years that we can't rely on it exclusively because the futures market is one of those things, once you think you've got it figured out, that's when it's going to pinch you.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, betting on oranges after the storm, next time on Marketplace from APM.
This evening at 6, following On the Media.
Bethann, you kind of play a game in your mind when you look forward to the end of summer's Gridiron Show. So what stories would I pick from the past year to make a comic song or skit out of? And inevitably, it's kind of an embarrassment of riches. As soon as you start thinking that way of the absurdities that we've seen in the past year, they just keep on coming, don't they?
Well, that's why there are rating sessions. And the last one for the coming show is going to be tomorrow. And then we'll have the show set and we'll know, and Kyoki. And Robbie and everyone who will be there tomorrow will have to then keep it all very secret, which is why I was hoping that Bill wasn't going to say too much about it. Because why would you want to come otherwise?
I don't think he did. I think that.
No.
But I would think that in the process, you would have to reject some stories that you would miss, that just wouldn't be room for all the ridiculousness.
Well, it's the story, and it's also the treatment of that story,
right?
The skit or the song. And, yeah, there are a whole lot, which is why, again, that these rating sessions happen, so that hopefully the very best of the best are chosen. The show gets put together and then starts rehearsal by the end of June.
I'm hoping that the proposal to restrict campaign contributions to natural persons. There's a song in that.
I can say nothing.
I just hope there's a song in that one. That's just personal.
Well, you keep that hope alive. That's a good thing. Well, that's going to do it for us on this Aloha Friday. Next week, we'll be back for the first week of June. We'll be talking with the plaintiffs in the sexual assault lawsuit against the Catholic Church. Also, some opposition to the Big Wind project on Lanai. They're back.
And a new look at one of the Second World War's pivotal battles and reaching out to kids through comedy improv.
Meanwhile, keep the conversation going. You can find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, tweet us at HI Conversation, or me at BCauseHPR. And if you like email, we got that too. It's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, the podcast, our links to more information, check the archive on our website, hpr2.org. Our executive producer is Bethann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Maddie DeShazo is our production assistant. And Andy Walters, Rylan Suahisa, and Alex Ellenberg are our summer interns.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. Have a good weekend. I'm Chris Vandegrift.
I'm Bethann Kozlovich. We'll see you back here on Monday and pick up the conversation.